Hello, and welcome to Thinking Aloud. My name is Mike Earle. This is show number 5. On the last couple of programs, I've been talking about something I call the new game. This new game is a kind of evolution. It's an approach to making sense of the world, the salient feature of which is adaptation. I call it the new game so as to contrast it against what I'm calling the old game, which is a non-adaptive approach characterized by assertions of knowledge. I'm reminded of something the reformer Martin Luther said about the astronomer Copernicus. He said, "This fool," the fool being Copernicus, "this fool wishes to reverse the entire science of astronomy. But sacred scripture tells us that Joshua commanded the sun to stand still, and not the earth." Of course, Martin Luther knew that the sacred scriptures were true and without error, which meant that Copernicus had to be wrong. That's the problem with assertions of knowledge. People who make them chain themselves to an idea that a more empirically informed generation may discover to be wrong. So buyer beware. Making an assertion of knowledge can be like booking a ticket on the Titanic. In the new game, we don't make assertions of knowledge. We reject the word's implicit attitude of infallibility, and in so doing, hopefully, keep ourselves ready to adapt our thinking should some unanticipated discovery so compel us. Last time I talked about what it means to experience progress in the new game. Today, I want to share with you what I believe to be the ultimate goal of the new game. Before I do that, though, let me quickly review what I said last time about progress. You may recall that I identified 3 dynamics of progress. Progress through the collection of more and more empirical data, progress through the abandoning of past mistakes, and progress through the formulation of new ideas able to explain a body of empirical data that previous ideas could not explain. Last time I also introduced something I call the 2-column model. This is a simple conceptual tool that I find useful in organizing my thoughts about the dynamics of this new game. As the name suggests, we have 2 columns, a left-hand column and a right-hand column. In the left-hand column, we collect empirical data. In the right-hand column, we collect the ideas that represent our attempts to explain the empirical data. Understood in evolutionary terms, the empirical data in the left-hand column is the environment against which the ideas in our right-hand column must adapt. This adaptation entails 2 activities. First, there is the abandoning of ideas that don't fit the empirical data. We can liken this to extinction. And second, there is the formulation of new ideas that do fit the empirical data. This is a creative function in which we formulate new generations of ideas. I'll be returning to this idea of progress and the 2-column model in future programs. For now, though, I want to share with you what I believe to be the ultimate goal of the new game. To introduce the subject, let's return once more to this game of fit the dots that I talked about last time. Recall that fit the dots is similar to a game of connect the dots in that we have a bunch of dots in front of us and we try to guess what picture they form. But fit the dots is progressive. And by progressive I mean that we don't get all the dots at one time. Instead, we start out with just a few dots, and over time we collect more and more dots. And all the time, we are guessing. As the game progresses, we may encounter new dots that reveal one of our guesses to be wrong. When that happens, we have to abandon the old guess and come up with a new one. In other words, we have to change. Now, it's easy enough to see how we progress in a game like this. We just keep adapting our guesses as the new dots compel us. But when does a game like this come to an end? I mean, since we're always collecting new dots, we can never rule out the possibility that at some point in the future we'll encounter some dot that we didn't anticipate, a dot that doesn't fit our most recent guess. Were this to happen, we'd find ourselves once again heading back to the drawing board to come up with a new guess. So the game continues. How do you win a game like this? Where's the finish line? When does the thing end? In the strictest sense, the game never ends. Now, what I'm going to say next will probably sound a little bit airy-fairy, but I'm going to say it anyway. We play the game with a kind of faith or hope, although I think it's a justified hope. Our hope is that as we continue playing this game, eventually the game will enter a phase in which we no longer have to revise our guesses. In other words, we anticipate a point in the game, sometime in the future, after which we no longer have to change our minds. Now, what could possibly cause something like that to happen? To answer that question, we need to remind ourselves what it is that causes us to revise our guesses in the first place. Anomalies. It is our encounter with anomalies that signals to us that there is something wrong with our current guess and that we need to make a change. Anomalies initiate this process. That being the case, our game enters this new phase of no more change when the anomalies go away. And that's what we're shooting for. That's our goal. The dynamics of this Fit the Dots game are exactly analogous to the dynamics of what I'm calling the new game. You see, in the new game, there really is no end of the game. There is no clear finish line. There is no point at which we stop and say, game over, mission accomplished. That's old game talk. In the new game, we don't have that. But we do have a goal of sorts, and that goal is to move the game into this phase of no more change, a phase in which new waves of empirical data no longer compel us to revise our picture of the world, a phase in which the anomalies go away. Now let me be very clear about something. This phase of no more change is not the result of any decision on our part. It's not like we all get together and vote to stop changing. That's how they do things in the old game. In the new game, change comes to an end not when we decide to stop changing, but when the anomalies go away. If the anomalies were to go away, could we then say that we had knowledge? No. And this brings up an important point. For even if we were to actually enter this phase of no more change, we could not know for certain that we were in it, even if we were actually in it. And that's because we never know what tomorrow's going to bring. We are stuck in the present. We're human beings. So even if there were to come a time in which we had been living anomaly-free for 1,000 years, even then we could not be certain that tomorrow might not bring us face-to-face with some anomaly, some unexpected piece of empirical data that would send us back to the drawing board one more time. So we keep playing the game, and we never stop. We always keep ourselves open to adaptation, even though we may have every reason to believe that we have finally arrived at the truth. Some people may find this less than satisfying. When playing games, we like to think that there comes a point in the game when the thing finally comes to an end. We like the idea of a clear finish line. That's part of the appeal of the old game. In the old game, there is a clear finish line, and both religion and science have their own versions of it. In the case of religion, the finish line is something called salvation. Now, like so many other hugely important words, the word salvation means very different things to different people. Christians have their heaven, Muslims have their paradise, Jews their Zion. There is, however, one feature all of these monotheistic utopias share in common, and that is the belief that salvation means that you get to live in the presence of God. Living in God's presence has real advantages from a knowledge point of view. Perhaps you can relate to this. Back in my religious days, I recall having discussions with other religious people in which we would speculate about certain historical mysteries. These mysteries would run the gamut from the fate of Jimmy Hoffa to the question of where Cain's wife came from. None of us had the answers to these vexing questions, but we took solace in the conviction that we would know the answers to these questions once we got into heaven. That's the advantage of living in God's presence, People in heaven have access to a kind of Godopedia. That's part of the prize you win for crossing the finish line of monotheism. That and not having to burn forever in hell. Science has its own version of a finish line. Actually, in science, there are many finish lines. Every piece of so-called scientific knowledge represents a kind of finish line. And so, for many scientists, the theory of evolution is a finish line. The Big Bang theory is a finish line. Quantum mechanics is a finish line. But these are little finish lines, partial finish lines. Many scientists believe that they are rapidly approaching a final finish line, the so-called theory of everything. Stephen Hawking famously refers to this theory of everything in his book, A Brief History of Time. He writes that when we finally cross that finish line, we will know the mind of God. Now, as I understand it, Stephen Hawking is, for all intents and purposes, an atheist, so his use of the word God is surely metaphorical. But to the extent that scientists embrace a theory of everything as knowledge, I believe they will be asserting an infallibility that transcends their human limitations. Perhaps Professor Hawking's use of the word God wasn't so metaphorical after all. Now, if this sounds like I'm bashing science, I suppose I am to a certain degree. But I just think it's a mistake for scientists to make assertions of knowledge. It's a mistake, and I think it's unnecessary. And in doing so, I believe they betray the very ethic of adaptation that has been responsible for their spectacular success in the past. Anyway, the point I want to stress here is that the old game of knowledge is alive and well, and it's being played by practitioners of both religion and science. In the old game, there are clear finish lines. In the new game, there are no clear finish lines. But we do have a goal, and that goal is to enter that phase of the game in which the anomalies go away. This post-anomaly phase of the game is something I like to describe as a state of conceptual equilibrium. Let me flesh out this idea of conceptual equilibrium. Whenever possible, I think it's useful to draw analogies to scientific principles. I say this because, as complex as our world appears to our senses, I believe everything that happens can ultimately be understood in terms of a few simple principles. So what often appears to be totally unrelated phenomena are really just different manifestations of a single underlying principle. When this turns out to be the case, we can draw on the lessons we've learned in one area of inquiry to inform our understanding in another area. Let me share with you what I think is one such example. There's a principle in physics the scientists call thermodynamic equilibrium. Let me read to you a passage from a physics text that describes this process. This is from Physics with Modern Physics for Scientists and Engineers by Richard Wolfson and Jay Pasikoff. They write, and I quote, "Take a bottle of soda from the refrigerator and leave it on the kitchen counter. Eventually it reaches room temperature and then stays there. We generalize this simple experiment to say that when two systems remain in contact until no further change occurs in any macroscopic property, then the two are in thermodynamic equilibrium." Unquote. Now, the process just described is something that I think most people understand, if only intuitively. There are three components of this process that I want to call your attention to. First, the process involves two systems. Second, the two systems are brought into contact with one another. And third, the two systems achieve a state of thermodynamic equilibrium when no further change occurs. In the above example, the two systems are the soda in the bottle and the air in the room. The two systems are brought into contact when the soda is removed from the fridge and placed on the counter. The temperature of the soda changes as a consequence of contact with the room air, and thermodynamic equilibrium is achieved when no further change occurs. What I am calling conceptual equilibrium follows what is essentially this very same dynamic. Like thermodynamic equilibrium, the principle of conceptual equilibrium is a state of no further change occurring. The process begins when two systems are brought into contact with each other. In the context of the new game, the two systems in question are the world as it really is and the world as we think it really is. The two systems are brought into contact by way of empirical research. Each observation, each measurement, each piece of empirical data represents a point of contact with the world we are trying to make sense of. As a consequence of this contact, our ideas about the world change. What causes this change? Anomalies. Anomalies signal a difference between the world as we imagine it to be and the world as we observe it to be. In response to these differences, we adapt our ideas until the empirical data no longer generate anomalies. When that happens, our ideas stop changing. Like thermodynamic equilibrium, a state of conceptual equilibrium is achieved when no further change occurs. And that is the goal of the new game. Let me quickly share with you a historic event that I view as an example of conceptual equilibrium at work in the real world. And to set this up, let's return once again to the physics example with the bottle of soda. I'm going to describe two different scenarios, and I want you to consider under which of these two scenarios would a state of thermodynamic equilibrium be most rapidly achieved. In the first scenario, we take the bottle of soda out of the fridge, place it on the counter, and then remove the bottle cap. The idea here is that we're going to expose a small part of the soda directly to the room air, that area near the top of the bottle. That's the first scenario. In the second scenario, we take the bottle out of the fridge, and like before, we remove the bottle cap. But instead of leaving the soda in the bottle, we pour it out onto a table so that it flattens out into a large puddle. In doing this, we expose a much larger surface area of the soda directly to the room air. Under which of these two scenarios would you expect thermodynamic equilibrium to occur more rapidly? Leaving the soda in the bottle or pouring it out onto the table? Obviously, pouring it out onto the table. Why? Well, because in pouring the soda onto the table, we greatly increase the area of contact between the soda and the air in the room. This greater contact causes the temperature of the soda to change more rapidly, thus achieving thermodynamic equilibrium much more quickly than if we had just left the soda in the bottle. I believe we have an example from our history books that illustrates this very same dynamic at work. Only this time, it's a case of conceptual equilibrium. The example I'm referring to is what we commonly call the Scientific Revolution. The Scientific Revolution has been a period of unprecedented intellectual advance that began some 400 years ago and continues to this day. Since the revolution began, our understanding of the world has changed dramatically and rapidly. What has caused this unprecedented change? Was there something present in the world during the Scientific Revolution that wasn't present before it? Was it the genius of men like Kepler and Galileo and Newton? I don't think so. I mean, clearly these men made enormous and indispensable contributions to scientific advance. No question about that. But men and women of genius had been walking the planet for thousands of years prior to this time. Archimedes, Aristotle, Aquinas, to name just a few whose names start with the letter A. So again, what was present during the Scientific Revolution that was missing before it? What was missing was the veritable flood of precise empirical data that commenced with the observations of Tycho Brahe on his island observatory of Uraniborg. Tycho's efforts marked the beginning of a whole new age of empirical observation. Within a decade of Tycho's death in 1601, Galileo was looking through his humble telescope at the moon and other heavenly bodies. From that time forward, it was as though a dam had burst. And today we observe the world with a precision that people before the age of science would have likely thought utterly impossible. What was present during the scientific revolution that was missing before it was empirical data. Think of how these dynamics play out in the context of the two-column model I talked about last time. For thousands of years, people of genius have been trying to make sense of the world. Why has the vast majority of intellectual progress only occurred within the past few hundred years? What is the difference? What's different is that we've poured our soda onto the table. We have flooded our left-hand column with empirical data. And in doing so, we have dramatically increased our contact with the world we are trying to understand. What about the ideas in our right-hand column? Well, what has happened there is exactly what we would expect to happen there, given that in a very short time, we went from having very little empirical contact with the world to having a great deal of empirical contact with the world. Just as the temperature of the soda changed more rapidly in response to its greater contact with the room air, so also have our ideas changed more rapidly in response to our greater contact with the world. And this change is not arbitrary. Our ideas about the world are adapting to this growing body of contact points with the very thing we are trying to make sense of. It's a change we have every reason to believe is moving us in the direction of truth. Moreover, it's a change that I believe will one day come to an end. But that's a good thing, because in the new game, if we stop changing, it means that the anomalies have gone away. And when that happens, we will have achieved that blessed state of conceptual equilibrium. We will have achieved our goal. One of my reasons for sharing with you this idea of conceptual equilibrium is that I want to juxtapose it against the idea of knowledge, which is the goal of the old game. As I have stressed many times now, the new game doesn't deal in knowledge claims because the new game operates within the limitations of human fallibility. Having said that, I want to make the case now that a state of conceptual equilibrium is, in one very important sense, functionally equivalent to a state of infallible knowledge. To illustrate, let's assume for a moment that the claims of those who play the old game are indeed true. In other words, they really do possess knowledge, and they possess it infallibly. Let's also assume that the knowledge in question is this theory of everything the scientists dream of. Only in our scenario, we assume they've actually got their theory, and they know it's true. And let's even bring religion in on the act, and imagine that God himself has made a personal appearance to scientists and theologians, and through an act of some kind of supernatural confirmation, God has impressed upon the minds of these scientists and theologians that this theory of everything is indeed absolutely true. If something like this were to actually happen, what would we expect one of the consequences to be? Well, consider this. This theory of everything is a conceptual model of the world. If it is a perfectly true model of the world, we can expect that when we compare the model to the world, we will observe a perfect fit. In other words, when we compare the model to the world, we expect to encounter zero anomalies. But notice something here. A state of zero anomalies is exactly what we're shooting for in the new game. So in terms of possessing a model that fits the world, the goal of the new game is functionally equivalent to the goal of the old game. It's just that in the new game, we drop this pretense of infallibility. What I wanted to accomplish today was to give you some idea of how I view the ultimate goal of the new game. I also wanted to reinforce this idea that the dynamics of the new game are consistent with principles that govern the behavior of natural systems, and that the new game itself is simply a manifestation of these more fundamental principles. Now, on the next show, I'll be responding to one of the common objections directed at those of us who reject knowledge claims. This objection is best summed up in a question that goes something like this. Okay, Mike, you say that we can't know things. How do you know that we can't know things? The contention here is that a skeptical position like the one I've been advocating is self-refuting. Many people view this objection to be a slam-dunk argument against skepticism. Well, if we've learned anything over the past few years, we've learned that slam-dunk arguments aren't always reliable. So you might want to check out my response. Another reason you might want to check back next time is because I'm going to be proposing an idea that will likely convince many of you that I am completely out of my mind. I'm sure you won't want to miss that. Anyway, I'll see you next time, and as always, thanks for listening.